I already explained to you what I'm going to do, so it's not going to be a big surprise here. Again, this is a small thank you for the membership. On behalf of the membership, this is seven plus 212 home runs. Seven you hit, 212 you gave up. So a net of 205. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Maybe 205 in the hole, but those 7 runs he hit, Carl Wilson's very envious. I'm Bill Marshall, and I'm in charge of the Special Collections and Archives at the University of Kentucky. We call that the hysterical section. We have a lot of history there. We have Happy Chandler's papers there. And so, my own research in baseball, which is surrounded his papers and the time that he was commissioner, not Chandler himself, but the time he was commissioner, has brought me into contact with a number of baseball players and owners and umpires and so on. I can't think of a player that I enjoyed interviewing more than Ed Gardner. Not one. And I had a lot of great interviews. You know, we all, most of us, go back in our childhood. I grew up in Cleveland. I didn't see Ed Gardner pitch when he was with St. Louis, but I certainly saw him pitch several times when he was with Detroit. And, yeah, sure, I had all his baseball cards, too. And even though my father didn't like listening to Jimmy Dudley, he liked listening to WJAR, which across the lake, you can get Detroit awful well. It's as clear as it is in Detroit. And so I also listened to Ned Gardner. Yeah. So for me to be able to do this, it is a great honor. I've introduced Ned Gardner, and then he's going to talk a little bit. And I'm going to ask him some questions. But fear not, we're going to leave a lot of time to throw it open to the audience for you to ask him questions. And I expect that you'll ask him probably questions until the time of the session is over. If you don't, I have more, so please do. But we just thought it would be nice to share with you someone who I think is really special as a baseball player and as a human being. Ned Gardner is the only major league pitcher to win 20 games with a team that lost more than 100 games in 154-game season in the 20th century. That is one, excuse my French, hell of a feat. He was 2012 to 1951 St. Louis Browns. In his first 5 seasons with the Browns, he was 59-68 with a 3.74 ERA. We're going to get to talk to you a little bit about what kind of a team that was. A real workhorse, he led the American League in complete games in 1950 and 1951. And folks, there were some great pitching staffs at that time. Cleveland, Detroit, Billy Pierce was over in Chicago, Mel Parnell was over in Boston. I didn't even say anything about the Yankees, we won't say anything about them. He constantly faced the best hitters the American League had to offer. His opponents knew him well. People like Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, George Gale, Nellie Fox, Mickey Vernon, Yogi Berra, Mickey Mantle. In 1951, Gardner was called to testify in front of the Seller Committee extensively as an example of a small market player whose skills were undercompensated. DiMaggio once reputedly remarked, "Poor Ned Gardner is a dirty shame." Ladies and gentlemen, I give you.
Great, you're very kind. I could give you a few more minutes if you want. Holy cow. That's great. You listen to that stuff, and I suppose my mother would have thought that a lot of it was true. I don't know. Anyway, I appreciate all those nice things. I'm not going to talk very long here, but we got 55 minutes or so, and I'm going to depend. One time I was in St. Louis at the Sabre Convention. Maybe some of you folks were there. Well, I want to tell you something. That was one of the finest experiences I ever had. because you guys know more about the son of a gun. You know more about the game than I do, seems to me like. So you talk intelligently. You ask intelligent questions. We get to talk about stuff that we know something about. And a lot of times that isn't the way it works. So I'm not going to just ramble on here. I'm going to talk a little bit, but then we're going to give you a chance. Now, if nobody asks any questions, well, then I'll talk about something else. I'll talk about those later. I can talk. I got a lot of stuff here. I can talk a lot of... You drink Pepsi and you get a lot of stuff. Well, anyway, you're going to get a lot of stuff if you don't ask questions. I guess that's the way it is. But, you know, I'll say it a little bit. I was born back in a little town in Ohio. That's where I was on a farm there. And I had two older brothers. They were better than I was. They were older than I was. And that's how you get good, is by having some God-given ability given to you, and then have that ability challenged. And so I was playing against people who were better than I was. And so that was just built in. That was just there for me. But I got a letter from... first year I played ball was at Newark, Ohio. That was a Class D. And I had a catcher by the name of Cy Coppa, Polish boy. And anyway, he sent me this not long ago. And in there it says, it's a trivia question. What pitcher holds the American League record for allowing the most career Grand Slam home runs? Anybody know who that is? Huh? That's right. You open this up, you turn it over, and it says Ned Garvin. He allowed 9 Grand Slam pitching for St. Louis, Detroit, and Kansas City. Now, but then it says also that Nolan Ryan, with 10, holds the National League record. So if a pitcher can be placed in the same category with a Nolan Ryan, you know, you don't really mind that too much. But I don't remember one home run with the bases loaded, because I don't think a one of them took a ball game away from me that I had won and took it away and made me a loser. Now, I had a couple times. I was in Boston one time, and Hutchison said, you can pitch. I had to have knee surgery. So he said, if you will pitch with 2 days rest here against the Red Sox, I'll let you go into the hospital early. The season was about over, you see, and he was going to have some minor league pitchers there. So he said, I'll let you go in early. And I wanted to go to Wyoming to hunt deer, so I wanted to get that sucker over with, you see. So he said, I'll let you do that. So I pitched with 2 days rest, and I went into the last half of the 8th inning leading 1-0. And George Kell was playing there at that time. All right. Well, that sucker worked. Okay, I can see a little out of one eye now, but it don't matter. So, anyway, George Kell was hitting behind Williams. The score was 1-0, and they had a man on base, man on second base. And it was 2 out, and Williams was up, and the count went to 2 balls and 1 strike. And Williams was a guy, now I don't criticize that, but Williams could see the ball better than most people, including the umpire. So if Williams didn't swing at it, he was pretty sure it was a ball. You see, so the umpires, that's the way they worked. So this pitch, I thought, was a strike. But Williams didn't swing, so the umpire said ball 3. Now it was ball 3 and strike 1. So I said to myself, 2 out, I'm going to pitch to Kell, because really and truly, Kell was a better hitter leading off an inning than he was with men in scoring position. In scoring position, the word was, you can lead him away. He's anxious to hit the ball, and he'll swing at some bat. He may get a hit. He was a damn good player. He's in the Hall of Fame. I ain't criticizing that, but he was a better hitter leading off. So I said, right now I'm going to pitch to Kell. Frank House was my catcher. He could catch anything. Frank House, you didn't need to tell Frank House what was going to be thrown. He could catch it. So I didn't take a sign. I just got the ball back, and I said, 3 balls, 1 strike. I just came up like this, went into my position, and threw the ball in here. Now, I didn't want to throw a wild pitch, so I just threw it in here. But plenty bad. And Williams, you know, didn't swing at pitches. He always said, if I start swinging at pitches out of the strike zone, he said, then a guy like Ed Lopat or Ned Garver will keep leading me out, leading me away, and pretty soon I'll be swinging at most anything. So they would criticize him for taking a base on balls in an important time at bat. So he didn't swing at bad balls much, but son of a biscuit, if he stepped back and he hit that ball out of the park. Now, that beat me 2-1, you see. Now, that wasn't a home run with the bases loaded. That was a home run with one man on. But I didn't forget that sucker, I'll tell you that. I can remember that to this day. But anyway, this guy says, my old catcher, Cy Coppa, he sent me this trivia stuff. So he said, it's too bad that you didn't take me along to the big leagues with you, because he says Polish catchers very seldom call for home run pitches with the bases loaded. I tell you, man, well, I thought that was pretty cool. Well, he would have helped me out if he could have been there, but he wasn't there. But I did another thing that I think you folks might be interested in. That's one of my highlights of my career. It says you won for the book here on June 20th. This is 21st. It was 51. That's about 45 years ago. Yesterday, I pitched this wonderful game in St. Louis. It says, well, there is no proof in the record books. Garver is believed to have established a modern mark when he went the route, despite allowing 18 hits. He went the route, allowing 18 hits, and he won 9-8. But I remember that game very well. Vicki Vernon was on that team, you know, a lot. Back in those days, I tell you, we had some pretty good horses. I think that St. Louis Brown team compete very well right now. Very well. But nevertheless, that had nothing to do with it. But they didn't hit the ball very well. See, and we never was behind that game. We were ahead in that ball game. We scored runs. So I was ahead in that ball game. There was no reason to take me out. I was a pretty good hitter. I was a pretty good fielder. I was ahead in the ball game. They weren't hitting the ball very good. They were hitting little high hoppers or little pop flies. They hit a few balls pretty good, and our guys caught it. You see, we made some catches out the outfield, remember? But nevertheless, that was no really a fluke thing there. It was just a game, just an odd thing. 18 hits, a lot of hits to give up. I was in Cleveland the other day, and who was it said that? You remember that? Okay, somebody said he pitched one of the guys there at that thing said he pitched a game, well, out 13 hits and shut him out. I don't know who that was. But anyway, I thought, 13 hits and shut him out, that's pretty good. But Frank Larry used to do that. Frank Larry, remember Frank Larry? Frank Larry, he I'll tell you something, he'd give up 11 hits and he'd win the game 2-1 or some crap. I mean, he'd get them on base, but they didn't get them home. He muscled up when they needed to. And I want to say something else about that home run crap. I threw a lot of them all right, but I hit seven of them, but I hit one. And that, you know, every pitcher's dream is to what? Win 20 games in the big leagues, right? 19 is all right, but 19 is nothing like 20. Okay, so you want to win 20. I had 16 with a few days to go, and the manager came and said, we're going to get you four chances, include, you're going to pitch pretty often, but you're going to get four chances, including the last day of the season. And, you know, so the odds, again, weren't winning four in a row with the Browns back in 51 was pretty high. But nevertheless, he was going to get me four shots, and I appreciated that. So I pitched about four times in about 10, 11 days. You know, bing, couple of days off, bing, we go. And I won the first three. Now we come up to the last day of the season and we're playing the White Sox. Now I got one shot. One shot to win 20 games. Never been done in the history. Bill Veeck was our owner at that time. He said, it's never been done. Nobody's ever won 20 games for a team that lost 100. Well, we'd already lost 102. So we knew we had that part taken care of. Anyway, he said, so there we were, the last day of the season. And I didn't have very good stuff. Or I might have, but anyway, they hit the snot out of it. So anyway, we go into the... Schermbauer was my catcher. And he couldn't run very well, he couldn't throw very well, and all that junk. But he was good up here, see? And he was good. I mean, really good. If it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't have won that game. But he came out there and he said, you got a good sinker. Well, the score was already about 4-4. It didn't look like I had a good anything. You know, we weren't doing too well, so I must have been not doing too well. But anyway, he said, you got a good sinker. Now he said, let's waste everything else for three, four innings, or two, three innings. And then he said, we'll go back to pitching normal. Well, that kind of buoyed my confidence up. Get back there and let's go. So I did that. We'd throw a slider, we'd throw it for a ball. We'd say, throw a changeup, we'd throw it for a ball. But the sinker, we made him hit the sinker. And I would, you know, they guess. They're going to guess slider on me a lot of times. So we got along for about 3 innings. And then he came back out and he said, okay, let's go back to pitching like normal. And we held him. They didn't score anymore. But that isn't what I was going to tell you. We had to score 4-4. Now, this is a big day. Big day in my life. Biggest day in my life, my baseball career. So the score is like 4-4 in about the fifth inning. And I come to bat. I hadn't hit a home run all year. But I hit one right then. All right, son of a biscuit. If you were going to write that for the Hollywood, and you'll make a story out of that deal. Here's a kid trying to win 20 in the big leagues. The last day of the season, score tied. He comes up, hits the ball out of the park. My doggies, that's a, you know, I think about that now. I don't even know how I did that. But I was so tickled. I remember seeing that ball went over the Sealy mattress line, left center field in Sportsman's Park. I was around first base, and I saw that sucker disappear. And I said, there you got it. Hold that. If you hold him, you're going to win. And we held him. Well, that's enough of that. I've reminisced here quite a little bit. And probably long enough. So that's all we're going to do is, I thought, well, we talked a little bit. You'll ask about changes and stuff like that. And it's pretty hard to know what to talk about to people, you know. We used to have a preacher, though. He was so good. He was so versatile that he thought he could talk, you know, about anything. So he'd been there a few years. So he initiated a suggestion box system. He put it in the church as we came in. And he said, anything you want me to preach on, you put it in, write it on a piece of paper, put it in there, and he said, I'll go to work on it. So that worked pretty good for a long time. Finally, one day he got up there and he opened that sucker up, and there was just one word on there, constipation. He said, well, that's a challenge to anybody's public speaking ability, but he said, since it is one of man's most persistent problems, he said, I'll do the best I can. And he said, fortunately, we have some appropriate scripture in the book of Deuteronomy, where it says, and Moses took the tablets and departed into the hills alone. Isn't that stupid? But I played a little bit of a town, a little bit of school. We didn't have height. We didn't have anything but basketball and baseball. We played baseball spring and fall. I had a good coach. You know, he told us, don't pay attention to the, you do your job. Don't worry about whether somebody makes an error. Don't worry about that stuff. I'll take care of the officials. You just play. And that's pretty good advice. I see pitchers later on, I got to the big leagues even. Somebody'd make an error and they'd get all bent out of shape. And they'd go to pieces. I had a good high school coach. I played 4 years of that. I went to Legion Ball. I went to Fort Wayne, Indiana. We went to state finals both in high school and Legion. And I got some good experience there. But then I went to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I played. We went to the national tournament, Federation League National Tournament in Youngstown, Ohio. And that little dinky team in Fort Wayne, Indiana, had three pitchers that went to the big leagues. Think of that. I was the third one. I played third base and outfield and stuff like that because I could hit the ball pretty well. But I was the third pitcher. We had two other guys. One guy, Heisner, went to the Red Sox, and Scott Carey was left-hander, went with Washington all of 1947. And me, three guys off that little dinky team. I don't think that ever happened again or before. But anyway, we got good experience there because with the black teams, the colored teams were touring around during those times. They weren't allowed to play in the leagues, you know, and boy, we played against some good horses. And that's how you get good. That's how you learn how to play. You don't learn how to play by dominating some. Some of these kids, they develop a little early, and so they're big in Little League and all that junk, and their parents and grandparents get all bent out of shape and all excited. What Judas Priest on? Maybe when the people catch up, maybe when they're 17 or 18, now everybody's about equal, then maybe they can't cut it. Who knows? A lot of depends on whether you want to keep learning. A lot of depends on how smart you are. A lot of depends on how much guts you got. You've got to, they're going to knock the snot out of you some days. That's all there is to it. And you got to be able to bounce back. You got to be able to learn from that. You got to get better as a result of that. And I was one of, they say that you learn more from losing than you do from winning. And so I was one of the smartest pitchers in America. I could lose. And old Satchel in his book, We used to spend a lot of time together. We were good friends. But anyway, in his book, he tells you that next to me, he said, Garver was probably the smartest pitcher in the American League. And I suppose that's why he got that, was because I'd lost so many games. I don't know. But anyway, we had a lot of... Oh, man, let's think of that. I got to be a teammate of Satchel Paige, got to tour, went go on barnstorming tours with him. Judas Proust Almighty. Got to be a work for Bill Veeck. Hey, Judas Proust Almighty. Somebody says, you know, too bad you don't play today, but you get the money. I'd like to have the money. I need the money. There's no question about that. I need the money. Like we talk about money here. He said, I said, what about pay? And he said, well, how about $100? So I wrote him a check, and here I am. Well, anyway. But there was some, that enough, isn't it? Well, you know, I think, you know, there was two things that happened to me. I got to stay up here, don't I? Well, anyway, you got to be a little lucky. You know, you got to be at the right place, right time. I got up with the Browns, and I got a chance to pitch. If I'd have come up with the Cleveland team or the Yankees, I'd have probably sat on the bench like Steve Gromick did over there at Cleveland. So you don't know. I never felt sorry for myself, never felt bad about being the St. Louis Browns. Judas Proust, I got up there, and the first 8 years I was there, I pitched 1,760 innings. I always averaging 220 innings a year. What the heck? And every time came my turn, I got to go out there. What more can you ask? You know, I never felt sorry for myself. But a couple of things happened. One time, here, I'm going to tell you quick. One time, I was in San Antonio, Texas. I'd played 2 years now in the minor leagues, and I'm in San Antonio, Texas, and I'm out there, and I could throw pretty hard, you know. I could hurt you if I hit you right in the head. But anyway, I couldn't throw it so hard, but I had some pretty good breaking balls, and I could get the stuff over the plate and all that junk. So, but I'm out there, just loosen up. You always loosen up. I don't care if you're playing in San Antonio in a day game, it's 110. You still go out there and play soft toss, so that my trainers always said, if you get your muscles stretched out, you're not likely to hurt them. But you got it. You can't walk out on the field, pick up a ball, and see if you can throw it to the wall. The first lick, you got to let your muscles stretch out. So that's what I was doing. I was just playing a little soft toss with another guy. And I threw this ball, and I didn't try to do anything with it or anything of the kind, but it so happened, I felt exactly what happened. I felt the pressure was on this finger, and that son of a biscuit slid. See? Now that was a slider. I'd never thrown a slider. I didn't know how to throw a slider. Nobody taught me how to throw a slider. I didn't read about how to throw the slider. I didn't do anything about it. I accidentally threw a slider. I said, get it back here. I mean, that excited me right away. I said, get it back to me. And he threw it back, and I took that son of a biscuit and threw another. And I threw a slider. Just like that. And I want to tell you something, that made the difference between, that took me to the big leagues and kept me there 14 years, I'll tell you that. Because Williams will tell you that I had a slider that was tough for him to pick the spin up on. And that's why I think he hit 10 home runs off me or something. He must have picked the spin up on it pretty good. I don't know. But anyway, I did have a pretty good slider. And I accidentally learned how to do it. Now, another thing. Here I go to spring training with the St. Louis Browns, 1948. We're going out to San Bernardino. We're coming back. I've been 2 years at San Antonio. So now I had a lousy spring. I couldn't get the college teams out. I had, you know, I didn't have a very good spring out there. So I'm the first, you know, I'm just a rookie. So now, if you're traveling with the team, they put your equipment in a tray. They wooden tray, and they put these trays in big trunks, and they travel that's the way you travel. And you sleep in a lower berth, you know, if you're on the team. But I was carrying my stuff in a duffel bag, and I was sleeping in an upper berth, and on top of that, every day I would be listed about the fifth or sixth pitcher. You see, he'd make a lineup card and put, and I have the starting pitcher, and then all these other guys, and I'd be about the fifth or sixth one. So if in case the game got completely out of hand, I'd be in there. So things were looking, I was pretty sure when we got to San Antonio that I was going to find my home there again. But anyway, we got to Tucson, we're playing the Indians. We're not too far from the season open now, see. Gordon's playing second base, Boudreaux's playing shortstop, and Kelton's playing third, and Dobie, and then they're playing their horses. So, Tiff Fannin, you know who that was. He was. He was a good hard-throwing pitcher we had. And he was going to be our starting pitcher. Well, we're over there. Our dugout was on the third base side. And Zach Taylor was in the dugout and a couple other folks, and that's about all. And their pitcher started to warm up over there. And pretty soon, and just at the time I was walking into the past the dugout, I heard Zach say, "Well, where's Fannin?" And somebody said, "Fannin is getting his arm loosened up." Bob Bowman was our trainer. He said, "Bob Bowman's loosening his arm up." Well, probably he was already done, and he was probably walking around in front of the stands, coming over here to get in this gate over by our side, and probably signing a few autographs as he went along, because he was a nice guy. And so he was just a little bit late, according to Zach Taylor, our manager. So anyway, he got irritated at that for some reason. And he said, "Garver, get your glove and warm up." And he was here at the end of the dugout, and I just walked past there, and I was just about out here. And I had my glove. You know, I didn't have to get it. I already had it. So the mound was right back here, and the catcher was right back here. So the guy went back there to warm me up, and I'd thrown about two or three. That's all. I hadn't thrown over two or three pitches to that guy, and Fannin came through the gate. And Zach Taylor said, "Let him go." You know? Shoot, it's true. So he let me warm up. I went out there, and I threw seven innings and gave him one hit, and that kind of opened their eyes. Seven innings, but again, the Indians were a pretty good team, and only one hit. So now we're going in a few days. We go down to El Paso, San Del Rio, and a few places. But a few days, we get to San Antonio. And I'd pitched there a couple of years, and I'd won 17 games. They got my name up on the fence there, they tell me. You know, I was a big wheel. No, not a big wheel. But they'd remember me there. So I suppose they figured they'd put a few people in the ballpark if I pitched. So they said, "You're going to pitch against the Cubs in San Antonio." Well, I shut them out. Went nine innings and shut them out. Shoot, that's crazy. They put my stuff back in the tray. They put me in the lower berth. They took me to St. Louis with them. And I stayed there for 14 years. You know, all because, in my opinion, Tiff Fannin was 5 seconds, 10 seconds late from getting his arm rubbed out. Now, is that lucky or not? Is that lucky or not? That's right. And if I'd have gone to San Antonio, who knows? I might have met a girl there and married her. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? Is that all? Let's go for something else.
He would happen to a Kentuckian. Cliff Mathis from Louisiana, Kentucky.
Oh, you're a good old boy, I'll tell you that. Good old boy.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions.
Yeah.
One of the things that often happens when people interview baseball players who have long major league careers is they really neglect their minor league careers. And I found that some of the players' minor league careers are sometimes even more interesting than their major league careers. Ned Garver's was extremely interesting to me. You started out in 1944, got out of service, and you married, making about $100 a month, and what, $1.25 a day for meal money. How in heaven's name did you make ends meet?
Well, my wife was good. She was frugal. I made the most money I ever made in 1 year. While we were the first 4 years I played, I made $2,200 in San Antonio the last year. Well, I'd been married there all that time, 4 years, and I'd played 4 years in the professional baseball, and she hadn't hardly saved a dime. See, I thought maybe I'd married the wrong woman here. Something was wrong. No, you just didn't make any money. Yeah, we got a quarter for breakfast and 50 cents for lunch and 75 cents. We got a dollar and a half first year. We got to the big leagues. We got, you know what we got? $4. $4 a day to eat on. They told you now, live. You're in the big leagues now. You dress like a big leaguer. You eat in the big league restaurants. You tip like a big leaguer and dress like a big leaguer and all that crap, and they paid you like a peon. It's pretty hard to do that. But now, I don't know what the question was.
Well, let me ask you another one that's really related to that question. You went on with San Antonio, and there's some dirty tricks. They sent you to Elmira to keep you from making
money. Oh, yeah.
Tell about that.
I hate to talk about that stuff, but that's they did. See, now the tail's wagging the dog. You know that. the players are in control of things. It swung the other way. But back in those days, buddy, it was terrible. I played, for instance, my second year, I had a contract with Toledo. And they said $100 more a month if you stay here all season. $100 more a month, that'd be for 4.5 months. $450 was a big deal for me. So do you know what they did? I had pitched in 28 games. 28 games I'd pitched for them, but they were going on the last Western swing out to St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Milwaukee, I think, and Louisville or whatever. So anyway, by Jove, instead of them taking me along there to beat me out of that $450, they sent me to Elmira, and they called me up the office, and they said, we're sending you to Elmira. They got a chance to get in the playoffs up there, and they need a pitching. Well, I got up there to Elmira. They just Bruce Almighty. They had no chance to get in the world in the playoff, and all they did have was pitching. I played, every day I didn't pitch, I played left field because I could hit. I got to play. I kind of liked that. I won 3 games up there, though. But nevertheless, I got to play. And then pretty soon they said, the Browns said, don't let him play anymore. So, but anyway, then they called me back to the last week of the season, to Zeta, and I pitched 3 more times in that week. I pitched in 31 games that year, but the Sons of Biscuits beat me out of $450. And I sent a letter to George Trotman, I think it was, the president, you know, the minor league thing. Never got anything. And then the worst thing was when I was at San Antonio and I won 17 games there. I was a pretty good pitcher, so I wound up getting no money. I went up in the middle of the year, a little after, and I asked him for a raise. And the guy said, we just got a call from Bill DeWitt today, and you're going to go to the Browns September the 1st. You're going to go up there for the last month of the season. Well, I came down those steps. The office was up on the second deck, second floor. I remember coming down. I can remember that just now. I came down those steps. I hardly touched a one. I was floating. Because here, I'm going to go to the big leagues. Jesus Christ. And I'm going to get to pitch. And I'm going to get $1,000 because the minimum was $5,000 at that time. I was going to get $1,000. So I was just tickled to pink. Well, we come to September the 1st, and they'd sold John Miller to the Cubs. And they said, you can't go now because we're a little shorthanded in pitching. So you'll go at the end of the season and end the Labor Day there. We're from Shreveport. So we got over to Shreveport, come the end of the season, I wired Bill DeWitt. I said, where do I meet you? And he wired back and said, you meet me in San Bernardino next spring. Holy cow. So I mean, now I write to the commissioner's office. And I think surely it's something. And you know what happened there? I never got a response from that sucker. But from next spring, I got from the DeWitts. He said, we know what you think of this organization because we have a copy of the letter that you sent to the commissioner. Now, the commissioner is supposed to represent the player and the management. Now, I don't think he was representing me at all. He sent a copy of my letter, and that wasn't all. I didn't say all nice things. You know, I mean, it wasn't something that you get in a good favor with them.
You pitched against Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio. How did you pitch to them? Did they have any perceptible weaknesses?
Williams was the only hitter that I ever went with. That Ted Williams was the only hitter that we ever had in meetings. See, you'd have a meeting before the series with the team. And day I pitched, I held a mini meeting. I didn't have everybody in there because I didn't want to have everybody in there telling you how good that other team was. You know, they tell you don't do this or don't do that, or they'll hit it over the fence. Well, I didn't. I knew that, I guess. But anyway, but Williams, they never said that he had a weakness. But they said, you know, if you keep the ball inside here and you keep it maybe down on the inside part of the plate, you have the best chance of keeping it in the park. Because he would, up here, he'd hit backspin on the ball and the sucker would go way. But if he hit this way, sometimes he'd hit it about like a golf ball, you know, go out and dive down. But Williams, DiMaggio was about, I only pitched to him about 3 years. And he was a little bit past his prime probably. He was only hitting like 321. But anyway, they told me, now DiMaggio, if you waste your other stuff and pump him inside with a little mustard, you got a chance of hitting him on the fist. You know, he can't get around. Now that's where you used to not be able to pitch him, was inside. But now that's probably your best chance. But I saw him in a card show a couple of years ago in St. Louis, and I had to tell him, we went to lunch, and I had to tell him, that never in my life did I ever have that happen to me before or since. And I'm pretty sure it's not going to happen again because they're not going to have the opportunity. But hey, he was at bat in St. Louis, and Les Moss was my catcher, and he had that target right out here on the outside corner, right here at the knees, and that ball would have hit right in that pocket. I threw that ball, my so-called good slider. Now, I always didn't want the people to play them to pull much. I said, they're not going to pull. If they pull me, they're going to hit a grounder to short or something. But anyway, he hit that ball. He pulled that ball over the left center field fence, back through across the bleachers that were there, and up against the back wall, right under the scoreboard. Now, that was a heck of a lick. And if you can do that, buddy, I'll take my cap off to you, because that wasn't easy to do. I never had anybody do it. If I could have pitched to all mantles, I used to tell Mickey, if I could have pitched to all guys like you, I'd be in Cooperstown before you are. Well, I could get Mantle out. He was, he hit 356 one year, so he was no dummy. But by the same token, Mantle had weaknesses. And most of the guys had weaknesses, but you try to get ahead of the guy and then maybe exploit his weakness. But not that. Vic Wertz wore me out. Vic Wertz was a problem child for me, and I did everything. He used to he'd say, what day are you pitching? We were over to Baltimore one time, and I got in there, and he said, what day are you pitching? I said, Thursday. He said, okay. He said, I'll have a cab at the hotel for you, because I don't want to.
But you know, in spite of Williams, that didn't keep you from a little challenging. Tell him why you challenged Williams.
Williams was the greatest hitter in the world. And if you got Williams out, here, the people didn't come see me. I mean, the year I won 20 or whatever, we did average like 15 or 1,800 or something, a couple thousand more. I forget more. We did draw a few, and I paid my way. I made them a little money that year, average than they would get other days. But, I'm in the same league, but then I'm not in the same league. The people don't come to see, they didn't come to see me. They came to see Williams. They came to see a Casey Stengel. They came to see DiMaggio. They came to see Mantle. They came to see the guys that could do the unusual things. Now, here's Williams, the greatest hitter that the game's ever known, in my opinion. So he's the greatest hitter. People come from those days when I was in Kansas City, let's say. People would come from Arizona. People come from Wyoming. People come from all those places to Kansas City. That was the closest town they could see him. To see Williams hit, they'd fill our ballpark. They didn't come to see him play left field. They didn't come to see him run the bases. You know what we'd do? They'd say, get the ball over to Dominic DiMaggio and Pesky, but if you walk Williams, that's pretty good. You hold him to one base. That's about all the time. You know, so even as Bruce Almighty, I thought if I could get, that was a real challenge. If I could get Williams out, I figured I'd done something. And so I figured also that the people had paid their way in there to see him hit. I thought we ought to pitch to him every time we could. We're in the entertainment business. If those people, they're entertained, they're not. And like I say, Williams entertained him when he was at the bat. Casey Stengel entertained him. He never went straight line to his pitching mound. He'd always weave around, give him plenty of chance to boo him and all that stuff. He was a colorful guy. But the most colorful thing I ever saw in my life was here. Satchel Paige was great. Satchel Paige was the best, in my opinion. Satchel Paige was the greatest pitcher that ever drew breath. Satchel Paige was in more ball games than anybody that ever drew breath also. But he didn't want to care to pitch when he was 10 runs ahead or 10 runs behind or 6 runs or whatever. But he's pitching in St. Louis, and it's the ninth inning, and the tying runs on third base. And the guy hits a bullet back at him, a one-hopper, though. See, it wasn't a line drive he caught like it. One-hopper, and he caught it right here, right about his knee. One hop. Boom. The hitter ended him out of the box. So he starts coming over to us. We're on the dugout at third base. He just starts walking over there, and like nothing's happening, you know. And I thought, I got nervous. I'm on the bench there. I thought, he thinks that he caught that ball. You know, and he never broke stride. I'm telling you the God's truth. He never broke stride. But out of his peripheral vision, evidently was good enough that he waited, he kept coming like he walked, and till he could see Hank Arft at first base, and then he just kept, and he just whipped that ball underhanded like that, whipped that ball underhanded right to Hank Arft. I'm telling you, buddy, that was something. That takes some guts. You talk about being a Vic Power. He was black, but he never thought he was colored, you know. So I mean, I had some friends down there visiting one day in Kansas City, and he stole home. And anyway, the next day, my buddy there, he used to be on the same team with me in high school. Anyway, he was complimented. We were out there early, you know, and he was complimented on his stealing home. And Power said, "Oh, no, no big deal." He said, "That'd be a night game." He said, "I wouldn't have had to slide." Yeah.
Why don't we throw it open to the audience and see if you have some questions to ask? And we'll start back there.
No. Hornsby was our manager, and he always got us to the depot and always got us everything way early. We'd get to the parks on the road way before the other team. The pitchers wouldn't be out there hitting yet. That was Hornsby's style. So we got to, I guess, Colton out there, suburb of Los Angeles or someplace. Anyway, we'd taken spring training, so now we're leaving. And we're out this to depot at Colton. And I think that was the name of the town. That one? Yeah, okay. So, and we had Milt Richmond. You know Milt Richmond? He was a syndicated writer. He's got a brother named Art Richmond now. He's the vice president of the Yankees. But anyway, Milt Richmond was a writer, and he was with us. And he was always telling about him when he was a track runner. He could run track in high school. Courtney challenged him to a race. He said, "I could beat you." So they got lined up. Gene Bearden was at the finish line. Then they took off, and they come on this macadam road. It was a blacktop, you know, just looked like it hadn't been down there very long. It was kind of a new macadam blacktop road. And they running, and son of a biscuit, Courtney pulled a muscle. He had a hamstring or whatever. And he started to hobble, and next thing you know, he goes right down on the road. And he catches himself, of course, with his hands in Judas Priest Almighty. He's sliding along like this, you know, and he just wears those out like crazy. Well, the trainer gets him, we get him in the, you know, getting the car, on the train, and the trainer patches him up. But, right, the next day, Hornsby had him in the lineup, and he made him catch a long time. Oh, man, that was pitiful. That was pitiful. But Courtney was big on a lot of stuff. One time, Ellis Clary and Les Moss from Courtney. Oh, I have so many stories with Courtney. But anyway, he was catching for Washington. And so they wanted to play a trick on him. And so they went in there to the clubhouse. Clary was part of that team, a coach or something. And he and Moss went in there. I guess they maybe had a couple beers or something. But anyway, they went in there to the clubhouse, and they unlaced Courtney's glove. And they took some Limburger cheese and put it in there between the leather, see? Now, here the next day, old Courtney's out there catching. And Courtney, he never lets off. The umpire, he's trying to find out what's happening. But Courtney, what's all right with him. He didn't pay no attention. That's unbelievable, but that's a true story. Yes.
Not here. I believe you told us in St. Louis a few years ago, I think it was you and I hope it was, that there are some batters to whom you can pitch better if you get behind in the count.
That's right.
Would you elaborate on that?
I learned that. As I came to the big leagues, I went to a guy like Tommy Bridges, and I asked him stuff. And I talked to John Whitehead and Moose Markham and those people that had been to the big leagues and now down to the minors, and I watched them pitch. Well, Bridges just said hitting is timing and pitching is breaking it up. Now, you take that, that's a simple thing, but that's the way it is. So now, I'm pitching in San Antonio, and we've got a guy by the name of Moose Markham, who'd been to the big leagues, and we're playing against Dallas, and they got a big guy by the name of Moyer, first baseman. He'd get that son of a biscuit out all the time, and he was wearing the league out, see? So I said, "What the heck?" And I asked Moose, I said, "You know, how are you pitching to Moyer?" He said, "I just waste the first two pitches." And then he said, I let up on him. I throw a change, and he always guesses for fastball, and he always gets out in front, and he always swings at me. That's when I found out that there's the, that's the way you do it a lot of times. And that not only the DeMoyer, but I did that in the big leagues. You get, you throw, I'd bust a couple fastballs and get behind. Now those guys, Dick Wakefield got so mad one time because I didn't throw him a fastball when the count was two balls and no strike. You can't, but I could throw something else. That's one of the reasons I was as successful as I was. I could throw something other than the fastball over the plate when I was behind in the count. But they always look, now there's some that won't. Kaline and Ray Boone, they'd look for a pitch, and if it wasn't there, they didn't swing at it. They look for a fastball on the inside, maybe. If it wasn't there, take it. I don't know what, I gave the trophy to Vec. I gave the trophy to Vec. It so happened that I was gone that day, and so from the hotel, from Kenmore Hotel. But anyway, I got back and I got to the ballpark, and Bobby Young was, he might have been the assistant. He might have been the assistant player rep, I don't know. But anyway, Bobby Young, our second baseman, had, he'd taken this trophy, got this trophy from a jeweler, and had the inscription put on it. See, I didn't even know that Hornsby'd been fired till I got, you know, back to the hotel or else to the park. And so I was a player rep, and my job, I gave the trophy to Bill Vec.
You guys didn't collect it
before? Oh, yeah, we took the money up. But I didn't take the money up because I wasn't in at that level. I might have got the money for him from him later on. But we paid for the trophy, oh, yeah. Bobby Young paid for the trophy and the inscription. And I don't know, you know, there was kind of, I never did find out about that. You know, maybe Bill Durney, the traveling secretary, had told him what to put on there or suggested what to put on there, because it's put on there for the greatest thing since the Emancipation Proclamation or something. Well, Hornsby was not a mean guy for us. Hornsby, I always felt sorry for Hornsby. Hornsby just didn't have any friends. Hornsby couldn't talk to you. Hornsby couldn't do anything. He couldn't manage. He couldn't, you what the heck?
You were relieved.
I really wasn't. It didn't make any difference to me. Hornsby wasn't. Hornsby, I could play for anybody. My job wasn't to manage. My job was to play. And if the owners hired Hornsby to manage, I played for Hornsby. I got along with anybody. I didn't have any trouble with that. And it was, certainly wasn't that they figured you were getting abused or anything. And he would. I saw Fred Hutchison grab a guy by the nape of the neck and bring him up there and shake him up, and I saw him throw a dead blame stool in the clubhouse and break it into smithereens, and a part of it flew over and hit Al Neuhauser on the back. I saw guys challenge players and fight players, but not Hornsby. Hornsby wasn't that way. Hornsby never cussed you out. Hornsby never said, but he did do something like this. He wouldn't let you put a screen up. Before we went on the field, they had to take the screen out. He let Hank Arf get hit in the head with a line drive. He let Gordon Goldsberry get hit in the head in the back with a line drive just because he couldn't put the screen up. And I was throwing batting practice and he hit a dead play ball right between my feet. Well, by God, I didn't like that. If you talk about whether I liked Hornsby, I didn't like him that day, I'll tell you that. Nobody's got a right to hit that dead play ball between my feet.
Right here.
Most play, guys you face, you do pretty well, you got their weaknesses. Ball here like Barrow.
Well, that was kind of tough. I mean, Barra would make out on a ball right down the gut just as well as he would any place else. But Barra was one of the best hitters I ever saw. Maybe the best. With the tie and run in the eighth inning on second base, Barra would bear down like a son of a biscuit.
Well,
and he would hit that ball where it was pitched, and he could hit it. I hollered, look out at him one time. He hit the ball out of the park foul. I thought it was going to hit him. Well, it would have hit him in the head. But he'd get the good part of the bat out there, you see? He was something special on that way, but he didn't bear down. Williams bore down every time at bat. Every time at bat. If he was going to be the second hitter, Vern Stevens was the hitter before, or whoever, Pesky, it would be Williams up there measuring you. Williams up there measuring. He never had a mediocre time at bat. He worked at it. And believe you me, I give him credit for that, because he was the greatest hitter. God gave him more ability, probably. He could see ball better than most people, but he worked at it, too. Yes, anybody else? Yes?
Do you recall where you were on June 6th, 1944?
Probably in the Eastern League. I was 44. No, I was still playing Newark, Ohio.
You were Cambridge, Ohio, because the exhibition game
against Cleveland. Indians. Yeah, that was my first experience pitching against big leaguers. Nice. Yeah, I did pretty well there. Nice. Somebody, Cullen Bine and Boudreau, though, they hit the rope. They hung them out a couple of
times. I was looking out the paper from Cambridge when you pitched that, because I was at
that game. Is that right? Well, I think most everybody there knew I was going to be a star. Yeah. Yes.
What about the Eddie Goodell incident? You remember anything about
it? I pitched the first game of the doubleheader when the midget came. You know, while Phil Beck was there a year, I was with him about a year, three things happened that only happened once in the history of baseball. Think of that. Well, think of that. One time. One was the midget. They barred it, of course, the next day. But he sent him up there, and we didn't know anything was going to happen. We didn't know what was going to happen. And I pitched the first game of the doubleheader, and I was upstairs. I got down there as quick as I could, but I was out of uniform. I had just showered. I was, you know, like you get, naked. So anyway, I had to get something on so I could get down there to the dugout to see, and it was practically over, but I've been told that by so many players, how he acted, went, and then Beck told me, he said, I told him, you swing, and this 30-06 is going to go off. I'm going to shoot you right in the back. He told him not to swing. But anyway, that was kind of nice. You know, he's got his contract. He walks up there, gives it to Ed Hurley. Ed Hurley looks it over. You've got to play. It's all signed by Herridge. So he gets up there. All he did was put a man on first base. I pitched already the first pitch I threw. The guy hit it out of the park. I'm one behind right then. He didn't do that. And he didn't put him in with the bases loaded in the ninth inning and the score tied to win a game. But then we had the grandstand manager's night. That happened once in the history of baseball, and I pitched that. And then we had... And then I won 20 games for the last place club. I mean, for the, you know, we're 100
more. There are people here who don't know what the grandstand measures like was.
Well, we had everybody there in the left and third base line. Everybody had a sign, yes or no. And our manager was sitting there in the stands, and he'd hold up a sign, infield in or bunt or whatever he'd say, and they'd say yes or no. So in the first inning, here's Lawler again, my old buddy, my old catcher friend. We're pitching, and I'm pitching against Philadelphia. They got two runs in, men on first and third, one out. And he says, infield in? They said, yes. So they got the infield in. And Lawler comes out to me and said, we can't play the infield in. He said, we got to try and get a ground ball and get out of this inning with a double play. So he stalled around. He goes back, and they still say infield in. So he comes back out the second time. Now the umpire's getting on us pretty good. But then they realize what's happening. And our manager, Zach Taylor, holds up a sign, and they said, no, infield back. So Pete Suter was the hitter, and I threw him a little sinker, and he hit a ground ball and turned it over, and that's all they got. We won the game. Big deal. I only tell about the ones I won. But I I lost a bunch of them. Yes?
It's the last question. Time for one more question.
What, among the umpires, what umpire would you say you really would like to see behind the plate when you're pitching, and what one or more did you not want to see behind the plate when you were pitching?
What you want first?
What you did want to see.
Did? Bill McGowan was the best umpire I ever saw. Bill McGowan would call the ball where it went across the plate. I wanted him to call the ball where it went across the plate. You see, because if you throw a bad blame, I had a pretty good slider. I had a pretty good sinker. I could throw the slider, and if I threw the slider and my catcher caught it just a hair off the plate, that was a strike. Well, that ball's breaking pretty quick, you see. But most of those umpires wouldn't do that. A lot of the umpires call it where you caught it. They, so like when Bob Feller got to throwing those big slow curves, Jim Hegan would get back as far as he could get back, and he'd catch the ball right back here. Well, that let the ball come around the plate, and it looked like it was a strike. But it wasn't close to a strike. Went across here. Then if he's catching Bob Lemon, the sinker baller, he'd be right up under the, in catching the way up here, see? Because the ball's sinking, make it look like it's higher. So, but McGowan was a good umpire. I'd pitch a game to him, and when it was over, I'd say, I don't think he missed a call. No, and I'm prejudiced, you know, but I mean, I didn't think he missed any of them. And Ted Williams called him number one, too. Old number one. And I think he was the best. Now, we had some other good ones. I thought Ed Runge was a good umpire. But we had some other good ones, and Paparella was a good umpire. But, well, now I shouldn't name every, but I remember one time, a guy by the name of McKinley, he was umpire, and I know he did the best he could. He was a good old boy, but he wasn't no good. He just wasn't no good. And so one time we had Bucky Harris as a manager. And Bucky Harris was not a guy to say much of anything in those days. He was mellow. He was nice. He wanted to be nice to you. He wanted to take you out between innings, not embarrass you by taking you out. You know, he was just a nice guy. But anyway, we're playing, and McKinley's umpire, and pretty soon after, you know, it looked like a lot of bad calls, but anyway, finally Harris did say, he hollered out there, and he said, they shot the wrong McKinley. I never went that far where I was going to shoot him. But some of them were better than others, that's no question. But if you had a guy like Charlie Berry, was a high ball umpire. Now, and you work different umpires different ways, you know. If he lets you throw, if he called the ball up here, strike. You know, if Charlie Berry was umpire, I could pitch high. I could go across the seams, and then I didn't have to throw so many sinkers. I'd go across the seams and help pump it up in here. I could throw hard enough to get it, you know, two strikes. I could bust one in here, you know, and keep him from getting around on the ball most of the time. So I pitched a little different to Charlie Berry than I did some of the other guys.
If you'd like to hear a little bit more, and it's probably all going to be unfortunately in Ned Garber on that 7th, ladies and gentlemen, Ned Garber.
Than I have at the Sabre Convention. You guys, I mean, it's a treat. I look forward to it. I'm tickled to death that they invited me, and it's a pleasure to be here with you.